Order.
Commissioner Studley?
Here.
Commissioner Heian?
Here.
Commissioner Liu?
Here.
I believe Commissioner Ward is coming, but he's not here yet. First item on the agenda is public comment on matters appearing or not appearing on the agenda that are within the jurisdiction of the Ethics Commission.
If you could let me know when I have 1 minute left, I would appreciate it. Members of the Commission, Ray Hartz, Director of San Francisco Open Government. This public comment is in reference to the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force Order of Determination number 10054, which was the basis of the Ethics Commission complaint number 06-110816. This order of determination was sent to this commission for enforcement and summarily dismissed by the staff without a hearing. Let me be perfectly clear. This is an issue of free speech. Not only is it free speech, but political free speech. Not only is it political free speech, but dissenting political free speech, which is protected by both the United States and California constitutions. The only reason for the position taken by the Library Commission in this case is to ensure that the dissenting political free speech and the political thought that speech represents does not make it into the official record of the Library Commission meetings. As opined by the Attorney General of California, quote, any attempt to restrict the content of such speech must be narrowly tailored to effectuate a compelling state interest. Now, you don't have to go too far to see an example of what it is when you addend something, how it affects it. Number one, it takes it out of context, which reduces the ability for anybody reading those minutes to understand it. And here is your own website, the meeting of January 10th, 2011. You'll see there in blue, it says, the second section, it says, Mr. Hartz also submitted a written statement which has been included at the end of these minutes.
Mr. Hartz, are you asking us to look at something right now? If you're asking us to look at that screen.
You have screens, don't you?
No.
No.
Well, I'll swing.
Oh.
If you page down to the bottom of the screen, it's not there.
Oh.
If you page to the bottom of the screen, my 150-word summary is not there. If you print out a copy from your website of the minutes, my 150-word summary does not appear. What you have to know is that little phrase up near the near the top that says a summary is included at the end of the minutes is a link. And if you click on the link, then the statement comes up.
He has a cursor, we don't, right?
So basically what happens is because the desire is to keep critical public comment out of minutes, the city attorney has taken the position you can append it to the end of the minutes. Now, if you read the Sunshine Ordinance, the clear wording of the law is it be at the end of the minutes.
Thank you, Mr. Hartz.
I asked to be told when 3 minutes, when 2 minutes was up.
Yeah, yeah.
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Patrick Manetshaw. I'm here on my own private time. I notice on the agenda for tonight's meeting and several of the previous meetings that my Sunshine complaint 013 and 014 have not been taken up by this body. It's been several months. When are you going to agendize it? I noticed on this agenda there's no mention of the Joel Gomez case that you referred to the mayor for enforcement. You need to agendize that and ask the mayor to show up during ethics question time and get him to come down here and explain to you why that seminal case, the first case you had heard referred from SOTF in a public meeting, and the first case that this body referred to the mayor for action has led to no action. The mayor should be ashamed of himself that he didn't address this before the election. After all, who wants a mayor that's not going to obey ethics laws? So I would appreciate hearing when you're going to agendize my two cases for an open hearing, and when you're going to agendize following up with the mayor to find out what he did with your referral on Ms. Gomez.
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Dr. Derek Kerr. I came this evening to appeal to you to review a complaint that Dr. Maria Rivero and I submitted more than 2 years ago involving a potential conflict of interest between former health director Dr. Mitchell Katz and Health Management Associates. I've just found out from Dr. Rivero that you will be discussing it in closed session tonight, so I wanted to thank you for taking this issue up. We've been waiting a long time, and we are both available if you need us to answer questions. We can appear in person or at any time at your convenience. Thank you.
Hi, Kimo Krasimir speaking here. I wanted to say that I'm a little bit disappointed that the Ethics Commission is not being receptive to feedback they're receiving from the public and from the city family in general. There's been a long clamor for televising of the Ethics Commission meetings, and yet only after the Board of Supervisors had their motion did you finally decide to do that. This argument, by the way, Mr. St. Croix, that it costs money is ridiculous. I've researched that issue with the SFGTV, and there are other departments that don't pay to have their meetings televised. In fact, the Board of Supervisors does not pay to have their meetings televised. it's a service offered to the city departments. Some do reimburse, but some don't. Of course, Prop F failed miserably, which was a good that, but the idea that the ethics could rewrite the law after the public had adopted certain provisions. It was disappointing that that was even proposed. I want to say that I'm sorry that Ethics Commission has been reluctant, well, has refused to respond to the Sunshine Task Force's request for a joint meeting. About 2 years ago, I attended a joint meeting with SOTF and Ethics, and it was, I think it was very effective. I think both the current commissioners and the Sunshine Task Force learned a lot about each other and their processes. And now I understand that the Supervisor Campos is basically forcing Ethics to have a joint meeting. Well, I mean, come on. I mean, how many times are you going to be forced to do things? This is really getting out of control. And the last thing I want to say is that I'm disappointed that this this response to SOTF's feedback on the ethics sunshine regulations is essentially almost no notice provided at all. It was made available Thursday, 123-page document, and I would strongly encourage that that discussion item be postponed to allow the Sunshine Task Force to respond as a body to that very lengthy document. Thank you.
The next item on the agenda is consideration of draft regulations regarding the Commission's enforcement of the Sunshine Ordinance. Mr. St. Croix, would you like to introduce this matter?
Okay. in 2010, we brought some changes to the regulations of how Ethics handles Sunshine referrals to the Commission. A few of the proposals were adopted, and we sent them over to the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force for comment. They did a pretty exhaustive amount of work and sent back recommendations to us, which we in turn reviewed. The staff did a very thorough rereading of the ordinance itself and synthesized what you have before you. as a result of reviewing what the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force wished, and a very clear, sober reading of what is actually in the ordinance itself.
So there are a number of decision points in the staff's memo. My plan is to take, obviously take them one at a time, although to take decision point one first, then 2A and 2B, followed by all those under decision point three, followed by those under four, and throughout, such that we would have public comment on each numbered decision point, but not on each subsection. Mr. St. Croix, would you like to summarize the changes in the preamble?
Essentially, the staff is saying that the commission only handles allegations of willful violations by elected officials, department heads, and managerial city employees who have the decision-making authority over Sunshine requests. There seems to be a an intent in the ordinance that people ultimately responsible for these decisions are subject to the requirements of the ordinance. But the way it's worded, it really, this section only refers to elected officials and department heads. So what we're trying to capture is also those personnel that either are designated by department heads as ultimately responsible for document requests or who are otherwise defined in charge of those decisions, have the last say on them.
Okay. If the other commissioners agree, I would like to take public comment first before we do our discussion. Decision point one.
I'm Alan Grossman, and I am truly appalled by your decision to proceed on what has taken your group and the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force the better part of 2 years to put together in the face of the following. Your staff ignored the task force request to see the report and proposal in advance, provide comment on it officially. They got it on Thursday. Actually, they didn't get it. Their administrator got it. Today is Monday. Secondly, the request to have a joint meeting to discuss their comments was also ignored. Third, this package is 123 pages. You couldn't have gotten it before we did, and yet you're going to move on it in 2 days. Fourth, Supervisor Campos has has plans to schedule a government audit and oversight committee review and possible legislative solutions to any areas of open access government enforcement that need to be addressed. And finally, and most, to me, most disturbing, is the staff says that the commission has officially retracted its decision to hear Sunshine Ordinance Task Force enforcements of its orders on simple violations. We don't know when that was done, whether it was done at a scheduled hearing. Nobody knows, because that was never officially made a part of any agenda of yours. I have before me a memo that lists four important legal principles that are not even mentioned in the report. Section 15.102 of the Charter. The first sentence of Section 3B2 of Article 1 of the California Constitution. The second sentence of Section 3B2 of Article 1 of the Constitution. And finally, 6735D of the Sunshine Ordinance, all of which are very relevant to these proposed regulations. They're not even mentioned. 6535D is actually quoted in full, but it's never referred to in the discussion of simple enforcement cases. So I'm willing to spend the time and read this to you, but I think at this point, to take up these decisions in the face of all of the time and effort that's been put in on the part of the task force members and those of us who've worked with them, and I've spent actually hours with Susan Harriman before she left the commission.
Thank you, Mr. Grossman.
Thank you. I'd like to leave copies of this.
Thank you.
That should be enough. Thank you.
Patrick Manetshaw again. The Ethics Commission is again displaying mind-boggling hubris, proposing regulations stipulating how it will or will not handle sunshine complaints referred for enforcement. Decision point one asserts ethics will, quote, enforce or review only allegations of willful sunshine violations by elected officials, department heads, managerial employees, wrongly exempting other city employees who may violate the Sunshine Ordinance. Ethics wrongly believes it isn't tasked anywhere in the ordinance with enforcing orders of determination from the task force. Instead, you appear to believe that only the district attorney or the attorney general are tasked with enforcement. None of the proposed decision points in these proposed regs were approved by the voters. Ethics may not adopt mere regulations that overturn sunshine open government laws voters have passed at the state level and or the local level. The proposed regulations are a bold attempt to repeal significant sections of the Sunshine Ordinance. Voters passed Prop G in 1999, creating the Sunshine Ordinance. Your job is to ratify the voters well, not to overturn it, as Prop E and Prop F would have both allowed last week on November 8th. We, the public, do not trust this Ethics Commission to suddenly become an effective watchdog of the public interest with these proposed regulations. Following defeat of Prop E and Prop F last week, it's shocking that you didn't learn your lesson. You can't overturn the will of the voters by a mere regulation. Hubris. It's too much hubris on that side of the table.
Hi, Kim Crossman here. I want to elaborate on some of the analysis that Mr. Grossman mentioned. I think one of the most notable points here is this section in the California Constitution. This was Prop 59. This was a provision adopted by signature to put it on the ballot and then was adopted at 83% of the voters of California changed the Constitution. This was the open government Prop 59 provision. And what it says is a statute, court rule, or other authority, including those in effect on the effective date of the subdivision, shall be broadly construed if it furthers the people's right of access and narrowly construed if it limits the right of access. Yet what ethics staff is doing is just the opposite. They are pointing out every ambiguity and then going to the most narrow reading of the provisions possible. That's directly against the requirement in the California Constitution. So right there, that's anything you do, as Mr. Manishawa said, a regulation can overrule a law, state law for sure. Secondly, if you're going to make a new ruling, you also have to look at this Prop 59 provision that says a statute, court rule, or authority adopted after the effective date of this vision that limits right of access shall be adopted with findings demonstrating that the interest protected by the limitation and the need for protecting that interest. What findings have been adopted by the Ethics Commission to validate and prove that these regulations meet that test? Again, the test is that findings should be demonstrating the interest protected by the limitation and the need for protecting that interest. You haven't done that. You can't make any adoption of any rules or until you make those findings. That's a violation of the California Constitution. I think I'll leave my points there.
Commissioners, Ray Hartz, Director, San Francisco Open Government. These comments reference decision point one. If the Ethics Commission decides to adopt this staff recommendation as is, common sense says it will result in any person making a public records request directing that request specifically to, quote, elected officials, department heads, and managerial city employees, unquote. If they do not, they will be in the position of working their way through a bureaucratic thicket until they reach, quote, elected officials, department heads, and managerial employees, unquote. Or worse yet, have to appeal to the supervisor of records, read city attorney, whose office has repeatedly proven to be hostile to records requests, representing everything in terms to which attorney-client privilege applies. In the alternative, failing to do so would place the requester dissatisfied with the response in the position of appealing the matter to the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force without the possibility of any enforcement from the Ethics Commission. I ran into the same situation with the Library Commission. I put it to the Library Commission. They were found in violation by a unanimous vote. It was referred to you, and it was dismissed because the person was not a managerial employee, et cetera. So I have filed another complaint against Luis Herrera, who is the city librarian, is, of course, a managerial employee, et cetera. And therefore, it will be one way of eliminating that excuse for not hearing the complaint. And bottom line is, any person who understands this law at all will stop requesting anything from anybody below those three positions, an elected official, department head, or a managerial city employee. I know I'm directing all of my public information requests to the department head. They keep sending me back to say, you have to do this to the custodian of records. And I go, no, the custodian of records is not a supervisory employee. So if she does not imply or implies replies improperly, I have no avenue because the only thing I can get is a determination from the task force with no possible chance of an enforcement from this body. So basically, this is, if you put it in this way, it is going to simply put people in a position where every single request in a department will go to the department head and every single request will go to some supervisor or managerial employee. Now, bottom line is they will still be responsible for doing it. They may delegate it to anyone, but as I learned in the Navy, delegation is not abdication. Just because I give it to an employee who is not a managerial employee doesn't mean I still don't maintain responsibility for that person doing their job and replying appropriately to that records request.
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Hope Johnson. I'm the chair of the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force. I will try to address them point by point. I have a couple of comments, and I hope that I capture the point that you're on, but if I don't, I apologize. Let me start by saying I really encourage you to have a joint meeting with the task force because we have a lot of experience hearing these cases, and that makes a huge difference. In fact, you guys have only heard one, and your staff had to change its policy directives because you realized they didn't fit with what a hearing is really all about. And we have a lot of people on the task force that have heard lots of these, and they could at least guide you so that you wouldn't be changing them as you have the hearings going along. So I just think that demonstrates why we want to have a joint meeting. Even if we don't necessarily agree, we have a lot of experience to pass on. And then to address the willful violation, on page 5 of the memo that your staff had online under Section 3, complaints alleging willful violations. In the 1, 2, 3, third paragraph, it says that they don't, the commission doesn't have jurisdiction to handle the complaint. And yet in Appendix C of the city charter, throughout Appendix C, it makes references that your duties with respect to the charter and city ordinance can include opinions, oral advice to managerial employees, employees that are required to say that they have training under the Sunshine Ordinance. So the fact, saying that you don't have jurisdiction is not consistent with the charter under Appendix C. And also, Ethics Commission staff has been dismissing referrals from the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force. And if you don't have jurisdiction, then you certainly don't have a basis to dismiss task force findings. And, you know, I think that the dismissal wording is probably misleading to the public. And then on page 10 of the memo, under the, it's number 2, the task force proposed to define willfully. In that second paragraph, in the last sentence, it says, in the context of the Sunshine Ordinance, a willful violation would occur if a respondent purposefully withheld public documents or violated public meeting requirements knowing that the Sunshine Ordinance required otherwise. That word knowing is a suspicious loophole to me, because Section 6733 of the Sunshine Ordinance requires that city department heads, managerial employees, and others are required to submit to the Ethics Commission a signed affidavit that they have Sunshine Ordinance training. So they have a requirement to know. And when you put that word knowing in there, it means you're going to determine something that they're already in the law required to know. So that's just an example. Thank you.
Ms. Johnson, I actually have a question for you, if you wouldn't mind. So looking at 67.35, does the task force believe that, my understanding reading the letter from the task force was that the task force does not think that the Ethics Commission should be the place where non-willful violations should be instituted. Is that...
Say that again?
That non-willful violations of the Sunshine Ordinance should not be brought in the first instance to the Ethics Commission. Do I correctly understand?
Well, the Sunshine Ordinance allows people to bring willful violations directly to the Ethics Commission or to the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force should they choose to.
Right.
We hear whatever complaints come to us, sometimes they're willful. But when we refer something to you, that's where the two, our opinion with the staff differs.
Okay, so you agree that non-willful violations of the Sunshine Ordinance should not be brought in the first instance to the Ethics Commission?
Yeah, in the first instance, and that if we refer it to you, it's not necessarily an investigation. That's something that I have another point about in your memo, but it might not fall under willful violations, so I might wait until you get to that particular point, but just if that answers your question.
Thank you, Ms. Johnson. It does, and I also appreciate your personal invitation to meet with the task force, and I think we should discuss that. Commissioner's comments on decision point 1. You know, this was a lengthy analysis that was provided by the staff. I think a good one. There was a lot of material and. You know, I certainly devoted a lot of time to looking at it, and I'm sure that my fellow commissioners did as well. I do, however, want to explore with the commissioners whether it would be prudent to talk about each decision point, but perhaps reserve motions on them either until the end or if we decide that perhaps further meeting with the task force or other public participation might benefit us in coming to this, in resolving these issues. Commissioner Studley?
I think that would be very helpful for a couple of reasons. One is a number of these are interlocking. They questions related to, as the chair just said, some of the issues flow through other decision points, and while we've tried to make them discrete, I'm not sure that any one of them stands by itself completely until I've heard the discussion. This ordinance has serious ambiguities and gaps. One of the problems is that we are struggling with a complicated document and two different sets of expertise and history. And I think we have made some progress in the back and forth to understand the issues better and to work our way toward manageable solutions. And as Ms. Johnson, is it again, said, we even if we don't agree on the particular solutions, I think there could be some value in both going through it at a reasonable pace so people don't feel that we have to do it this minute, and also to seeing at the end whether it would be helpful to have a joint meeting. I think that that and the time for reflection, I think the point is well taken that this is complicated stuff for people to reflect on in just a few days. So I appreciate your suggestion that we walk through all of it and see where we see clarity and where we might want to pursue it further.
Okay, and I would like to add also that I think in many respects, now having the staff's memo, which again I think does a very thorough job, and the, I think the proposal also is quite thorough. Now having that, I actually think now having some sort of meeting with the task force would be particularly productive, or at least have the opportunity to be productive. With respect to the specifics of decision point one, any comments from the commissioners?
Sure. I'll ask one that was hard for me as I was reading through this again. It seems that there are two issues here in terms of scope that is related to our jurisdiction over willful or all violations and over the actors who might have, against whom complaints might be lodged, that it appears that, I wonder whether in one case we aren't sticking with the actual, trying to do this without too many negatives in a document that already talks about willful and non-willful, so I'm trying not to get tangled. It appears that in one respect, related to the code authority, we are sticking closely to the literal words about willful violations. In the other, where the only people referred to are elected officials and department heads, we are considering adding managerial city employees. And I would just be interested in how we square that with the interpretive provisions. Is that in one case saying that's what it says we have and therefore that's what we have, and in another case we're expanding it? And if not, to just articulate some help in articulating the distinction. And I think the constitutional principles that people referred to may be part of the reasoning there.
So I mean, I share a similar concern, and I think one way to perhaps address it is for the second sentence of 67.34 to not. I don't think we should be trying to add managerial city employees into that sentence. I think that we can define, perhaps we can define department head or department heads broadly enough to encompass those to whom the department head has delegated the authority to respond to these complaints. You know, that's something that perhaps we should look into, but something I think worth considering, because I am concerned that we aren't adhering to the plain language of the ordinance if we try to add managerial city employee into that sentence. At the same time, I think if we're going to be consistent with the task force's recommendation that we do not, in the first instance, hear non-willful violations, to me, the only way to reconcile that position with the ordinance is for us to not handle non-willful violations at all, because there's 67.35 does not appear to provide any basis, unless our jurisdiction is limited to willful violations, for us not to take non-willful violations as well. So to me, reconciling that those two sections requires, one, limiting our jurisdiction to willful violations, and two, defining department heads in a way that encompasses perhaps not just the department heads, but those who have the authority to act on behalf of the department head.
You know, if I could just add one point. I find it frustrating, that's what I meant about the ambiguities in this, that in the case that one of the speakers referred to, that if we don't have jurisdiction over the people who are really supposed to provide the information to the public, then we can see that the information was not provided, but if the actor doesn't fit within our jurisdiction, we're stuck and there's nothing we can do, and that is frustrating and limiting. On the other hand, I can picture somebody who is not defined in the ordinance saying to us, where did you get the authority to define me, you know, to penalize me because you don't have jurisdiction over me? And that's what I mean by the gaps in what might be the hope behind the ordinance, but not embodied in the words that we have to work with. And that is a source of frustration for people who are looking to us to be able to do something that we may not legally have the tool to do. So our solution may be, you know, outside, the solution to some of these could be outside a back and forth between us if we actually say there are revisions that need to be made. And whether you put it here or there, you can't have the actors who might have failed to carry out a responsibility that the public wants to see effected, to have no tool to handle a failing that the law wants us to get at, but we can't reach the players who may be the ones who had the responsibility for carrying it out. I like your notion of if we can build on the department head's responsibility as opposed to drawing in a new set of people, but actually saying the department head in some way through the person to whom there was a delegation made. If that solves it, I would be, you know, I would appreciate that way of being able to join the issue.
Commissioner Hand?
Well, I guess my question is, can we not add language that simply says willful violations by elected officials and department heads and employees that are under their department or their or that report to them? Is that not narrow enough, or is it too broad? I mean, essentially, if you're a department head or a manager or an elected official, I mean, you are ultimately responsible for whatever goes on in your department or your area of jurisdiction, so that if I'm the head of a department, I assume that anything that goes wrong within that department ultimately comes to my desk. So why cannot that philosophy be applied, some simple language that then allows us to take the department head to task, even if in fact the violator is, you know, some clerk somewhere that willfully denied, you know, some aspect of the Sunshine Ordinance.
I'm happy to let Mr. St. Croix, the city attorney, address this if I can't. But I think the issue is, the ordinance itself provides for us to handle complaints against department heads and elected officials, and so we're trying to stay within the the bounds of the ordinance, but provide enough clarity such that we can effectively implement it. So that's why the idea of defining department heads to include their specific delegates who have final authority over the issue might sort of balance those competing concerns. I don't know if you wanted to add anything.
I agree with that. It sounds like there are two different kinds of discussions, two different ideas that are floating here. One, Commissioner Han, you're suggesting that all violations of the Sunshine Ordinance should be, the department head could be penalized for any violation of the ordinance. And Commissioner Hearn and I think Commissioner Studley are saying, ultimately the commission should be able to penalize specific individuals, not just the department head, who have final authority over sunshine, over sunshine responses. So I think the question that the commission is grappling with is, who exactly can you impose penalties against? And I agree that the reading of the ordinance that a willful violation by anyone in the department is a willful violation by the department head, it's probably a stretch factually in any given case.
But when we introduced a new class of employee into this?
No.
I'm not talking to you. And when public comment is available, then you can speak. Okay? So we introduce a new class of employee that's subject to this. But don't we also introduce a new defense? If a managerial employee is saying that I'm not releasing the documents because I'm being told by my department head not to, is that a defense from a willful violation?
Or a shift. So to the department head.
If it's an elected official who's responsible or a department head, there's no such defense. Well, in the case of department heads, they're appointed by the mayor. But
I mean, in that instance, I would think that the person bringing the complaint could name the department head as the respondent. If they're being told that I'm not providing this to you because the department head has told me that I cannot fulfill the request.
Well, they might tell the complainant or they might not. But they might present as a defense in a hearing that it was because I was directed by my department head not to release it. Is it a defense?
So would that go, then that would go to the question of willfulness?
Yes.
Have they proved a willful violation if they're just being told to implement, carry out orders or directives from somebody else? Then maybe in that instance, I mean, to Mr. Givner, would we be able to find a willful violation against the department head, even if they were not specifically named, if that was sort of the defense that came up?
It's all in how you write the regs. I think that sounds, what you're describing sounds like a willful violation by the department head, and you just want to write the regs in a way that captures that possibility.
Mm-hmm. So on that point, actually, Mr. Givner, can you talk a little bit about what the commission's authority is for drafting these implementing regulations, and are there any parameters? I mean, obviously, we have to make sure the regulations reflect the intent of the ordinance. And is that the only parameter, or is there anything more specific than that?
Yeah, that's the primary parameter. You know, unfortunately, there's not much in the legislative history of this ordinance that goes to exactly how the ordinance was intended to be enforced at this level by the Ethics Commission. So you're really looking at the words of the ordinance, putting these two provisions or three provisions together, and as Commissioner Studley said, there's several reasonable ways, I think, to read these provisions. And so it's a matter of taking, of making the most, coming up with what is the most reasonable interpretation in light mm-hmm. of the overarching intent of the ordinance, which was to ensure public access to records and mm-hmm. and in the city.
Mr. Givner, reference was made to some of the constitutional provisions in this area. Could you speak a little to how we might turn to them, or is that something we should might?
I can't speak off the top of my head on that. I'd say, you know, right now, taking what Mr. Crossman and others said about the constitutional provisions, I'd say as I mentioned, the ultimate goal of these regulations will be to effectuate the purposes of the ordinance by coming up with an enforcement mechanism that's true to the letter of the ordinance. And I think the goals of the ordinance are consistent with the goals of the constitutional provisions that were mentioned earlier. But that, if you'd like more specific discussion of the effect of the constitutional provisions, I'd have to do it at your next meeting.
Okay. I mean, we may want to see how the chair decides to proceed on these.
Okay, so my recommendation is that we move to the next decision point without a vote. I think we've, you know, expressed our views on section one, and personally I am in favor of the staff's view, except for redefining department head rather than inserting managerial city employee. But in my view, given the complexity of the issue, it may be worth deferring voting on this. But I would be happy to hear from Mr. St. Croix and the other commissioners. Do you have any?
Are you planning to go through then the whole thing tonight, just do a discussion and no votes?
That was my thought.
Given,
then, go ahead.
I was just wondering if, given your estimate of how long the other items would take, might you want to set an amount of time, or would you prefer that we go through all of them to some degree?
Well, I think the staff did a lot of work on this. Yeah. I think, and like I said, I think they did a good job on it, and I think it would be helpful for us to have as clear a sense of what we think the mm-hmm. issues are and know mm-hmm. them well, so that if and when we address this with the task force, we'll feel like we're very well prepared to do so. But Mr. St. Croix, was there anything else you wanted to? Timing-wise, the issue, not the timing of the meeting today, which I am sensitive to, but in with respect to getting these finalized, I mean, we received from the task force their response in August. You guys, the staff has now prepared this memo. We're discussing it today. I assume, and perhaps Ms. Johnson can speak to this, that the process that we've described right now is, although it would take more time to get regulations in place, you feel it could benefit the regulations we ultimately adopt. Is that a fair characterization?
I mean, there's a couple things I'm surprised you didn't tell them, that there are really specific exemptions. The discussion you were just having, there are really specific exemptions under the California Public Records Act, and that California law trumps all of our laws. And saying that your boss told you not to do it or didn't do it, that's not one of them. And so some of the things that you think are gaps, they are covered under the California Public Records Act. Some of them are gaps, and they do need to be revised, and we did work on that. But some of the, in state law, documents are all public, and it's the city's burden to show an exemption to keep that, to keep them from being disclosed. So it's a little bit different from the legal world where it's the opposite, where the plaintiff has to come in and say, you should disclose these. And that's all under the California Public Records Act, which isn't in here. So that's some of the things that will come up when you hold these hearings if you do, which is why I think that some of the experience on our task force, including DCA Threat, who helps us, advises us on the task force, he could also have some assistance in this too, because he's been there and has those things come up. People, we also here have jurisdiction under the California and the Brown Act. Mm-hmm. So some exemptions the Ethics Commission couldn't, you could put them in your regulations, but they would be in violation of the state law.
My question, and I appreciate that clarification, but my question is, you know, one of the reasons we're here and trying to do this so quickly is because we are sensitive to wanting to have regulations that we think are going to be effective and make sense and do the best we can to interpret this ordinance. And having a process where we now will, you know, delay implementing these regulations in order to hopefully, you know, improve our response is going to lead to these regulations not being adopted tonight and is going to, you know, result in them it taking probably a few more months. But if you think that's a good idea, to me that would be helpful to sort of
I do think it's a good idea
where you stand
on the condition that we might have some kind of interaction with you beyond just going through Mr. St. Croix with the actual commissioners so that you can understand some of the things that actually come up in hearings, because I think that even it, you know, that it will help you understand where we're coming from. This idea that sometimes the California Public Records Act. So if you had a meeting with us, pushing it forward a few months, it would definitely be beneficial. Even if you don't, I still think that it would be beneficial. And Supervisor Campos may call us in front of the Government Audits and Oversight Committee.
Thank you.
In that time.
Decision point two. Mr. St. Croix, would you like to introduce what's at issue here?
So it covers the issue of handling of non-willful complaints, the timing of scheduling of hearings, making it clear that hearings on these sunshine issues will be public.
Public comment on decision point two.
Good evening again, commissioners. Decision point two says that the commission does not have jurisdiction to handle non-willful complaints. Commissioner Ward's response to me during the previous decision point and some of the questions by Commissioner Smudley prove that this commission doesn't know what you're doing, which is exactly why you should table this to another meeting. You are not, Commissioner Ward, introducing a new class of people to 67.34. 6734 currently reads elected officials, department heads, and managerial employees. It's there. You're not introducing anything new. To the extent some of the commissioners may not understand that, means that you need to go back and read the Sunshine Ordinance before you pass any kind of regulations that will alter the Sunshine Ordinance. As I said earlier, this body is not allowed to overturn the will of the voters. The voters very clearly passed Section 6734 that includes managerial employees. You are not introducing anything new, and you may not take it out without going back to the voters and asking them for permission to take it out.
I see what you mean.
To that extent, you could move this along quickly tonight, and instead of going through 9 or 12 decision points, one of you could introduce a motion to table this discussion until after you rightfully meet with your peers on the Sunshine Task Force and with Supervisor Campos. And if there is any ambiguity in points in the Sunshine Ordinance, you might avail yourself of requesting Assemblyman Tom Amiano to come and help clear up some of the intent of the original ordinance and the amendments that were passed by the voters. It's not as if Sacramento is on another planet. You could get him over here to find out what some of the intent of the original language was.
I recognize that you have a need to get these regulations adopted, but I think the cost to the community would be unimaginable to somebody who's spent years looking at the problems associated with enforcement of the task force orders. And I'm as close to that probably as anybody here, having actually had to sue the commission to get information on why these cases were dismissed. And that pattern has continued. But I think the basic issue is you better decide what your role is going to be. You're either going to be the instrumentality that I think everybody in this community believes is the one to enforce the Sunshine Ordinance. The district attorney has declined to do it. The attorney general has declined to do it. And you are the only other body that has that capability. And under the charter, you have the obligation, once you adopt these rules, to affect the purposes of the ordinance. And the people, when they adopted it in 1999, they were really serious that this was an important factor. So by parsing around as part of his managerial employees included, who this one or that one, you're missing the boat totally. The real question is, are you going to take your responsibility and enforce the orders of the task force? Because that's the place where everybody goes to get relief, and that's the place where they're going to get it as far as the task force can do it. And then when it shows up before ethics, if you insist and say that we don't handle enforcement, we only handle violation, willful violations, then you've just eliminated 95% of the individual requester's ability to get public records or to be properly heard at a public meeting. And I say this with all due respect. I'm a lawyer. I practiced over 60 years. I just came back from my 60th law school reunion.
Congratulations.
And I can tell you I know more about these issues than your staff, which in the two lawyers who wrote this report, their combined experience is what, 12 years, 9 years? I've lived with this for years, and I'm associating that fact, the fact of my experience and knowledge, with the responsibility that you have to write this and
thank
to
you,
adopt
Mr. Grossman.
Regulations.
And,
thank
and, you.
Know,
and while also, while I appreciate your experience, and I think you have added to this process in the past, and I'm sure you will again in the future, I do not appreciate any attempt to denigrate the fine work that the staff has done on this.
I'm sorry, my hearing is not as good as it should be. I missed your last comments.
I said I don't appreciate suggesting that just because the staff has less experience than you means that they can't do a good job on these regulations. That
well,
was the intent
it wasn't
of
meant
my...
disrespectfully, I assure you. It
okay.
only
Thank
means
you.
That in certain professions, experience really matters. Thank you.
Thank you.
Hi, Kimo Crossman. You know, there was a discussion about experience, and I don't think I'm going to continue on with that. Again, I'm seeing ethics. I know ethics commission deals with the intricacies of election law and, you know, who's a political candidate and who isn't and how money can be spent. But You're forgetting again, I'll bring it up again, Prop 59, constitutional amendment, a provision that your fine attorney here can't even speak to tonight about. He told you, I can't speak to that off the top of my head. The provision says, well, there's ambiguity, you know, you have to interpret any law or, you know, court rule or other authority broadly, not narrowly. So I'm not seeing you do that. I'm seeing you adopt these things narrowly. Additionally, you have to adopt findings to justify any new rule that you do. You haven't adopted any findings for any of this stuff yet. So that's in the call for a constitution. So I don't know why you're progressing down these points without addressing those really critical aspects of Prop 59, which is the open government provision. Additionally, I would recommend that when you have a question about the interpretation of the Sunshine Ordinance, you defer to the body that is empowered to interpret the ordinance, and that body is the task force. If you have a question about managerial employees versus non-managerial employees, write it up and send it to the task force. They are the experts. They are given the power. That's their jurisdiction to interpret the ordinance, and defer to them. Find out their experience and the power that they are given by the voters to interpret the ordinance, and defer to them for that information, especially when they actually know the California Public Records Act, they know the Prop 59, they know the relevant provisions of law that unfortunately your council doesn't, and your staff doesn't either. Additionally, I just point out to you in 6735D in the Sunshine Ordinance, it says any person may institute proceedings for enforcement and penalties under this act on any court or competent jurisdiction or before this commission. So clearly you have the power, and that's not limited to any willful or managerial. It's you have the power to enforce under the act, that covers all complaints that are referred to you by Sunshine.
Evening, commissioners. My name is Bruce Wolf. I'm the vice chair of the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force. Pleased to meet you. This is probably my first time meeting you all and you meeting me. I hope that we can meet each other again to discuss some of these matters in more detail in the future. I think what's important is I'm going to suggest that you not take any action tonight. And the reason why is because there are some issues that our legal counsel might have that are different than what your legal counsel has. And I think that meeting needs to have happened in a public session. I think that's just really important, especially with regards to the first decision that you were discussing. I had just walked in after public comment was over, around the differences between the first sentence and the second sentence. And there are some pretty standard rules of constitutional law when there are statements made at the beginning of a sentence of a paragraph that carry through to the end of a paragraph when there's no break in the paragraph. And I think those things need to be laid out. It's been quite clear with our attorney that if everything is contained in a paragraph, that they hold true from what is said from the beginning of the paragraph. So I think it would behoove us all to make sure that we are all on the same page, or that we come to some agreement, or that if we are in disagreement, that we find some body entity or some body of law to help us determine exactly how this is supposed to be read and what is the force of law. I think that's would be behoove us all, so this doesn't get prolonged ad infinitum, and would save us all a lot of time. So I appreciate your time, again, I would reiterate what the last speaker said around 6735, because I was going to mention that in that there are provisions for enforcement by your body to any person that chooses to bring it forward, even though there are some conditions. They have had to, it would have not had to have been taken up by a city or a state official otherwise, but be it as it may, there is that provision. So thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
Good evening, Commissioners. I'm Richard Nee. For the benefit of your record keeping, it's K-N-E-E, just like elbow. First of all, again, I want to thank the Commission for its patience on this whole thing. This has taken a lot longer than you would have liked. It took a lot longer than we on the task force would have liked. But we're an all-volunteer body, as you are. At times, we had trouble mustering or maintaining a quorum, and that prevented our moving forward with this as quickly as we would have liked and as quickly as you would have liked. So it's dragged out a lot longer than we all would have liked, but continued patience on this, I think, is of paramount importance. One other thing, as you move forward with this, I think one of the things that you're going to want to consider is the intent of all the Sunshine laws. And in the case of the Sunshine Ordinance, there are three people I think you might want to bring in consultation on this. First one is Terry Frank, F-R-A-N-C-K-E. He is the General Counsel of Californians Aware. He wrote the original language of the first ordinance, the 1993 version of the ordinance. The second and third are the co-drafters of Prop G in 1999. Their names are Thomas Burke, B-U-R-K-E, and Stephen, with a P-H, LeBlanc, capital L-E, capital B-L-A-N-C, I believe that's one word. Both of them, all three of them, are still practicing. And if it is the will of the commission, I will be happy to provide you with their contact information. And again, I encourage you to bring them in on this.
Thank you.
Good evening, Commissioners. My name is Dr. Allison Washburn. I'm chair of the Compliance and Amendments Committee of the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force. I'm also past president of the League of Women Voters of San Francisco, and I hold Chair 5 on the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force, which is the league's chair. And I wanted to comment, first of all, Commissioner Studley mentioned a while ago about how complex these issues are. And in preparing for tonight's hearing, I reviewed a lot of material and then read Mr. St. Croix's analysis and his recommendations. And after having decided that I was, you know, looking at all of this one way, some questions arose and continually arise. I think that it would behoove all of us to schedule a joint meeting where we sit down as peers with different areas of expertise to review these very complex issues that are interesting and very, very important, and bring in the various people that Richard Nee just recommended, who drafted all of this in the first place, have our respective DCA members with us. I think all of these good heads could hash out these complex issues and come up with some regulations that would be helpful to us respectively and certainly to the public. So again, I respectfully invite you to join us in discussing all of this further before you take action. Thank you very much.
Commissioners, Ray Hartz, Director of San Francisco Open Government. These comments reference decision point 2. If the Ethics Commission decides to adopt this staff recommendation as is, it will result in all city boards and or commissions being exempted from the Sunshine Ordinance if they so choose. Since neither board nor commission members nor their staff are typically, quote, elected officials, department heads, or managerial city employees, unquote, they could reply or not reply to such requests with impunity. They would know that the worst that could happen is the referral to the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force with no available avenue to the Ethics Commission for enforcement. Should it choose to live up to the moral and ethical obligations I believe it has, at a minimum, the Ethics Commission could place pressure on members of boards and commissions to comply with the law. In such cases, we're unable to exact a penalty. The Ethics Commission could use moral suasion to ensure compliance. And that was one of the issues was related to my complaint with the Library Commission. One of the reasons it was dismissed by the staff was because this person was not a managerial employee, et cetera. Well, that's basically saying they can just disregard the law because you're saying you can't do anything to them if they do. And that's pretty much the attitude they've taken with two determinations on the same issue. They have simply refused to comply. Now, I'd like to just take a view, a moment to kind of give you a sense of what I feel I've been hearing from members of the public, which is you have the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force, which is composed of members who have for a dozen years been dealing with all of these complex issues. And you are attempting to do something that you have basically never done as a body. You have left all this work in the past to the staff. And it would be hard for me to understand how you would really understand many of these issues without reference to using all of the experience that is provided by the task force. You could sit down, hash them out, and you, the commissioners, are the ones who have to make the decisions, not the staff. And I've said this before, if you don't do that, my feeling is you've abrogated your responsibility, you've delegated to the staff, and then you say, oh, our staff was wonderful and they told us this, and you have to go with it. So we're matching 12 years of experience of the task force members in that body at dealing with all of these issues against your one case that you have heard, period.
Good evening, commissioners. My name is Suzanne Manet. I hold seat 4 on the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force. I'll make my comment brief, essentially to echo my colleagues on the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force and just really highlight how extremely critical it is because of the fact that a lot of these issues are so complex and the unfortunate fact that we have not had the most ideal form of communication and cooperation. It will certainly behoove us as a Sunshine Task Force, as colleagues working with you as commissioners, and as well as the future for open government and the entire city of San Francisco in going forward to really meet and discuss these issues. I really hope that you consider this and everything my colleagues have said. Thank you.
John, you're going to look great on TV, man. You and I share the same heritage and complexions and stuff that dies in front of the big screen. I just have one thing to say, and I have it for Ms. Studley and Mr. Herr. The thing that stood out in this entire meeting to me, pardon me, I'm a layman. I mean, I do nothing but read this kind of stuff. But the thing that stood out was when Alan Grossman stood up there and said, I just celebrated my 60th with my class 60 years ago from law school. I mean, my God, 60 years, that's unbelievable. And then Commissioner Herr insulted him because he said, experience means nothing. Now, I immediately went up to the guy and I said, Counselor, 60 years, how many people showed up at the reunion? He said, 32 out of a class of 550. I said, that's fantastic. I said, what was the school? And he said, why, it was Harvard. And you know that, Commissioner Herr, and you know that, Commissioner Studley, because you both went to Harvard. And please don't insult elders in the presence of other elders. There's nothing the matter with experience. Now you want to shoot at me after I sat down, Mr. Herr? That's what you did to Mr. Grossman.
Okay, having heard all this public comment, I am thinking and reconsidering my earlier proposal and interested in what the other commissioners have to say on this. To simply table the issue, I think, You know, we've spent time with the memo and with the ordinance, and I think we understand where the staff is coming from. But table it until further discussion, perhaps with the task force or with others, to ensure that we have as much public confidence as we can in the regulations that we ultimately adopt.
I'd be happy to make a motion to that effect.
As would I. I support that. I think that is quite reasonable under the circumstances.
I think that's a good approach, too.
Okay. Is there a motion?
So moved.
Second.
Public comment on the decision to table the discussion.
Commissioner Herr, you probably made the best decision of your career, whether that's 12 years or 60. I suggest that you all read the Sunshine Ordinance closely. Most of us
closely,
broadly, and not narrowly. Most of us who have filed complaints with the Sunshine Task Force chose not to come directly to this body because of your reputation on not exactly supporting open government from the citizens' perspective. Those of us who have repeatedly brought complaints to the task force and have repeatedly won referrals to this body have read every word, comma, and space in that ordinance. And I think you need to not only hold this joint hearing with the task force, you need to schedule an all-day City Hall open to the public meeting all day long to go over every word of every one of your eventual recommendations. You cannot take away from the voters what they passed at the ballot box. So after you meet with campuses committee and the task force, what you really need to do is not write a regulation that attempts to overturn an ordinance. You need to turn it into amendments to an ordinance and take it back to the voters and let them decide. This is our city, our democracy. It's not up to a panel of five or Ms. Johnson's panel of 11. It's up to the voters. These are our laws, our democracy.
Commissioners, Ray Hartz, Director of San Francisco Open Government. And this is something that I, in the past, have said to the Sunshine Ordinance Task Force itself, which is it seemed in their discussions that they seemed to be spending much, much, much more time talking about why they couldn't do anything than talking about what they could do. And I really do feel that if you meet with the task force, they're a very agreeable group of people who want to really make this work for themselves and for you, and most of all for the citizens of the city and county of San Francisco. They want to ensure that citizens have the right to speak. And it's amazing sometimes you go before certain bodies. I went before the police commission and was told point blank, you're not allowed to talk about that. You're not allowed to question the way we handle our agenda. And this was a police commissioner who's an attorney, a member of the California Bar, and had gone through the Sunshine training four times. And he's standing there saying, you can't talk about that. I think one of the reasons you don't see as much discussion about the public comment portions of the Sunshine Ordinance is because many of us relax and we think, well, for good heaven's sakes, we have the First Amendment in the United States Constitution, we have the California Constitution, we have the California Public Records Act, and we have the Brown Act. I mean, how much more do people need to know that getting up in front of a body and speaking is a right that people have? And with rare exception, does any member of a body have the right to stop them? The same thing goes with public records. Public records belong to you and I and all the citizens of the city. They don't belong to the department heads or the departments or the employees or anybody else. They are public property. And the fact that many city employees do feel that is within their right to withhold documents, which they have absolutely no right to withhold, and then drag the complainant through onerous hearings before sunshine, only to find out later that it isn't going to be enforced anyway because you guys can't agree on how to do it. I've referred to the application for public records to the Sunshine Task Force as a long, 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 long form to apply for public records. They are getting much, much better, and I think the experience they have would benefit you greatly.
I am still Richard Nee. Respectfully, I would suggest that any meeting you have with our Compliance and Amendments Committee be held after the first of the year for two reasons. Number one, it gives us a little bit of time to, a little bit more time, I think, to review the package that staff has put forward. And number two, holiday season's coming up. A lot of people are going to be traveling. It'll be, I think, easier to get people to a meeting if we wait till after the first of the year.
Next item. Vote. Is there a vote on the motion pending? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion passes. Next item on the agenda.
Mr. Chair, I know that you don't need a defense, and I think that the record as stated will reflect that at least I heard nothing in what you said to be disrespectful of Mr. Grossman, but simply to stand up for the quality and commitment of our legal staff. I think it would not be, I, for one, just don't want to leave the implication that you were disrespectful, because I have found that you are never that. Thank you.
I echo Commissioner Studley's comments and also echo Chair Herr's comment of appreciation to the staff for your very hard work and thorough analysis, which is very helpful for this, for our discussion on sunshine regulations.
Right. And I'm sorry that a number of people have left, but I would also like to thank the members of the task force, because I think some of the most constructive comments and the willingness to cooperate, I'm very influenced by Chair Johnson, Mr. Nee, and the vice chair whom we just met, that they do seem to, and the other member of the task force who spoke to us, that I think there is a genuine invitation there to try and work through this, and I appreciate that.
Yeah, I think that such a meeting is absolutely essential, you know, and we need to go through it at a meeting where there is nothing but that on the agenda.
I'd just like to chime in to say that I agree with all
this. The next item on the agenda is consideration of requests for waivers for the post-employment ban from regarding Ms. Tiffany Bohe.
Yes. Ms. Bohe is here.
Before we begin with this agenda item, I'd like to state for the record that while Ms. Bohe and I have never met, we don't know each other, my employer, Yerba Buena Center for the Arts, is a SFRA project, and we receive a substantial portion of our annual budget from SFRA, and for that reason, I think it's wise that I recuse myself consideration of this matter. And so I do.
Actually, you have to have a vote.
Is there a motion for Commissioner Ward to recuse himself from this matter for the reasons stated?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Comment? Public comment?
Public comment? Seeing none, is all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes. So
you have to leave the dais. You can stay in the room or you can go outside.
So that's the only way to get to the bathroom.
Mr. St. Croix, would you like to introduce this?
Yeah. The CFRA is, although a state agency, is not another side. It's not a competing interest with the city. Its work dovetails with city work. So in this situation, our evaluation is that there's not a built-in conflict of interest. Ms. Bohee will be promoting the same objectives that she did in her prior job in her new job, and that they dovetail together. And invite her to come up and just introduce herself and give the commission a brief background on her request.
Through the chair, Tiffany Bohee. I'm the executive director of the San Francisco Redevelopment Agency. Thank you for having me here this evening. I'm here before you to request a waiver on two items, as your executive director has indicated. In my previous capacity with the city, as a project director for the Office of Economic and Workforce Development, my key role was to advance redevelopment projects which promote the economic vitality of the city, revitalize our neighborhoods, and provide housing for our poorest of the poor to those with working families. Similarly, the redevelopment agency, as Director St. Croix has indicated, the missions are quite closely aligned. There's no opportunity for me to have any undue influence or advantage. Both the redevelopment agency, at the behest of the mayor and the board, and working closely with the city family, advances these goals to increase the tax base for our city, provide affordable housing. So I'd like to continue that role as executive director and be able to closely coordinate with my former employer and work cooperatively to advance these citywide goals.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Any questions for Ms. Bohee from the commission?
Can I ask a question?
Yes.
Ms. Bohee, thank you for coming tonight. In your letter, I think you refer to a legislative package that you're working on. Is that the only project for which you're seeking a waiver, or is there more just sort of your job in general that you need a waiver for?
I believe it's that specific legislative package. Should the last summer, the legislature and the governor passed some redevelopment realignment legislation to redirect funds to schools and certain taxing entities, but not all, like BART and other things. The California Redevelopment Association and the League and a couple of other cities, like Union City and San Jose, challenged that, the legality, the constitutionality under Prop 1A and Prop 22. The court is deliberating now. They just heard oral arguments. And should there be an opportunity for redevelopment to continue, and both the mayor and the board have indicated so in resolutions passed this summer, that yes, redevelopment for our city is a good thing, the promotion of affordable housing, neighborhood revitalization. That particular package of legislation, pending the outcome of the court decision, which we expect in January, is what I'd specifically be working on, what I've asked for that component of the quote-unquote switching sides, I think. Okay. Waiver.
Okay, thank you.
Any other questions for Ms. Bohee? Thank you.
Thank you.
Commissioners, any objection to taking public comment, if there is any, before we discuss?
No, thanks. That would be fine.
Is there any public comment on this matter? Comments from the commissioners?
I think it's important that we look carefully at waiver requests because there were good and sound reasons that the restrictions were adopted, but I also think that we were given the ability to allow for waivers when it was did not pose a danger of the kind that led to the restrictions in the first place. And I think the staff's recommended I don't know if it's a clarification or a narrowing, but the specification that it only be a waiver with respect to responsibilities at CFRA makes sense, and I'd be comfortable supporting this one.
Any other comments?
I agree. I think that we should take waivers seriously, but here I'm persuaded that the interests are aligned and there would be no undue advantage or undue influence. And so given that and given the director's, Jennifer Matz's recommendation as well, I would be persuaded to grant the waiver.
Is there a motion?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
All opposed? Motion passes. Thank you for coming, Ms. Bohe. The next item on the agenda is a closed session. Is there a motion to move into closed session?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
Public comment on whether we should go into closed session? Seeing none, all in favor of moving into closed session?
Aye.
Aye.
All opposed? The motion passes. We will move into closed session. So we need to clear the courtroom. And do I, can I? Okay, we're back. The next item on the agenda is...
to do a motion not to discuss.
Oh, right. Is there a motion not to disclose the deliberations regarding the matters that were discussed in closed session?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Public comment, sorry.
And for the record, you should announce the settlement decisions that were approved.
Okay. Do we do that now or before public comment?
You can do it now. It probably would.
Okay.
You good?
Okay. Commission announces that it has reached a settlement agreement in the following two complaints. Complaint number 28-101026 and complaint number 03-061016.
Public comment.
David Pilpel. That raises two issues. The settlements that were reached, are the material terms or the settlements themselves available at the present time? And if not, when will they be available? Whatever they were, I have no idea what those matters relate to.
Well, they were in closed session and they were confidential until they were adopted by the commission. They'll be posted on the commission website tomorrow.
And are they not available at the present time? Or can the material terms be disclosed if the settlements have now been finalized?
You can disclose the material terms. My understanding is there aren't copies for the public, but...
I think it's going to be difficult to... I mean, the documents are, you know, they're not one-liners. So I think, given that it'll be posted tomorrow, I think that's our intent.
At a minimum, could you announce who the respondent was, what the matters related to, just something? Because yeah. You obviously know what's going on, and we have no idea out here.
Yeah, I have no objection to that.
Complaint number 28-101026, is entered into by the Commission and Common Sense Voters, SF 2010, vote for Mark Farrell for District 2 Supervisor, regarding a fail to provide full disclosure on a campaign mailing. That's efficient.
Okay.
The other one, 03-061016, is into between the MAC 06 committee, Jane Ray MAC candidate, and Francis Shea treasurer. And there were a long list of it's an extensive list of findings, which would take too long to read.
That's fine. I understand what they were related to now. That helps. Thank you.
Thank you.
And then the other concern was with regard to the closed session. I was not here at the beginning. My understanding is that it's possible that Mr. Katz was present in closed session, and I'm trying to understand on what basis someone who's not a city employee could have been present in a closed session. If you can just explain if this was something prior to a preliminary hearing or the nature of the thing. I'm not interested in the basis of the complaint, just how someone might have been present who was not, who was just essentially a member of the public. That just seems odd.
You're entitled to your public comment. I mean, we had a matter that for which it was appropriate to be in closed session, and that's
and the
and appropriate for Dr. Katz to be here.
And the minutes will so reflect the whoever was present in closed session, although not necessarily the full circumstances.
The commission will consider the minutes at their next meeting.
Okay. I guess what I'm expressing is that it is frustrating to not understand how someone can be present in closed session who, under a normal read of the Brown Act and the Sunshine Ordinance, would not be allowed to be present in closed session. And to the extent that the commission could explain that without going into the details of whatever the case is, that would be helpful and illuminating. If the commission can't do that, that makes it frustrating for those of us in the public who witnessed that and could give rise to further complaints. And
may I add one?
I think that would be good to avoid.
Commissioner Liu?
There was no exception made to the rule. He was appropriately present. There was not an exception made for him to be present.
Then I guess I'm trying to understand under what rule such an individual could be present if that person is not a city employee. And if non-city employees are excluded from closed sessions, it doesn't reconcile.
That's what we can tell you, Mr. Pilpel.
Okay.
This is public comment. I mean, you have an opportunity to make
I understand, and I appreciate
not,
that you're giving me a little more latitude on this. I just would think it would be nice if we could avoid that closed session giving rise to a further complaint and more processing on the commission's time. So this might be an opportunity if you can address that. If you can't, then so be it.
Is that a threat?
No, it's not. It's actually not. I have other things to do with my time. It's not me.
Feel free.
Okay.
I think all we can say is that there are other public policies at issue that prevent us from answering that question.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Other public comment?
See you soon.
Is there a motion? Or all in favor? Aye.
Aye.
We made the motion to keep deliberations regarding confidential matters in closed session. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? Motion passes. The next item on the agenda is continuation of consideration of possible amendments to CFRO. I believe where we left off, we were on decision point 7. Staff has recommended that we skip decision points. Seven C1 and C2, but that we start with decision point 7A.
May I also add that this commission also skipped consideration of 7D upon a closer review of it. I think it really pertains to the D, 7D. So we recommend skipping 7C1, 7C2, and 7D because they pertain very much to the structure of the public financing program.
Okay.
I'd be happy to answer questions if you like. I'm not sure how you would like to proceed.
Can you introduce briefly the changes proposed in 7A?
Sure. Basically, what we want to propose is that we eliminate a requirement that candidates who want to seek public funds file a statement saying that they are interested in seeking public funds. This requirement is no longer necessary and actually proved to be a hurdle for a couple of candidates in the last supervisorial election because the election campaign fund is now funded through the allocation of $2.75 per resident. This actual provision in 1.140A1 and 1.42A are things that, I mean, they refer to a statement as really not necessary because we have sufficient funds now. Well, generally speaking, we have sufficient funds, but these predated the funding of the election campaign fund.
So why does that relate to whether a person seeking public financing needs to file a statement that they intend to participate?
What we needed to do early on in the public financing program was to get an idea of what the universe of candidates were going to be so that we could seek appropriate funding levels.
I see. Comments from the commissioners on 7A? Seem pretty straightforward based on Missing's explanation. Public comment? Is there a motion to adopt the changes proposed in decision point 7A?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? That motion passes. 7B.
7B currently requires applicants for public financing to agree not to pay any contractor in exchange for contributions and also to agree not to pay any vendors more than 50 payments. Staff recommends deletion of this because we don't think that this is necessary. There are rules that you can't pay for a contribution, and also the 50 payments amount seems pretty arbitrary. So you can make big payments to contributors, but you cannot make 50 small payments.
Any questions or discussion among the commissioners? Public comment on this item?
David Pilpel, I have no objection to eliminating this subsection C, lines 10 through 13. This does raise, though, a thought that has come from a few meetings that I've been at in the last few weeks related to public financing generally. I know that we're going to talk either tonight or at the Interested Persons meeting on Wednesday and thereafter about the appropriate threshold for participation, whether that's 5,000, 10,000, somewhere in between, how to qualify, all of that. But there was a thought that the amount of funds that were spent, both in this cycle and in general, don't necessarily get kept locally, that there were candidates and committees that purchased services through vendors, because this was all, this section was about contractors and vendors, out of town, printing, mailing, political consultants, whatnot, and that although we might not constrain candidates receiving private funds, those receiving public funds might have to agree, for example, to something like the local hire legislation that Supervisor Avalos passed. Shouldn't they spend, you know, at least 50% of their funds on vendors in San Francisco so as to keep the money and the jobs in the city? Are there other kinds of public benefits or restrictions that we might put on public finance candidates or those campaigns receiving public funds that may be environmental, social, that sort of thing? I think this was not necessarily in that basket, but I would encourage you to think about those kinds of provisions that one might appropriately burden publicly financed candidates with. I think that's a discussion that we should have, again, either Wednesday or thereafter.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Is there a motion? Sorry. Take your time, sir.
Hello, I'm Larry Bush. I just wanted to respond, first of all, to the question about directing campaigns on how they can spend the money. Is that there are state laws that say, for example, that if you're going to hire people to do robocalls into San Francisco, you are required to hire people who are out of the state. That's a state law, and you can't get around it. I don't know what other laws there are, but that's the kind of thing that if you're going to look at, you might make sure that you're consistent with whatever the state requires. And as long as people are throwing out wish lists, I would say that I would like to see a requirement that says that at least one communication, however it's done, should go to every San Francisco voter. Because I think one of the points of public financing is to encourage greater participation. And we know that there is generally greater participation if people are reached with the message about candidates. So it seems to me not an unreasonable thing to say that each voter should get at least one communication, since the voters are paying for it. And that's not relevant to your entire hearing.
Thank you, sir. Is there a motion with respect to the deletion proposed in decision point 7B?
I move that we accept the staff recommendation.
Is there a second? All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. All opposed? That passes. The staff has asked us to hold off consideration of decision point 7C1, 7C2, and 7D. I also wonder, for the same reason, whether it makes sense to put off decision point 7E, because that amount could be changed depending on what the ceiling ultimately becomes.
Do you mean 7F? I'm sorry.
Well, yeah, 7F. Sorry, 7F.
Yeah, we can certainly do that, yeah.
Okay. But I guess that leaves 7E, so we should probably do that. Ms. Ng, do you want to briefly introduce
that? Sure. 7E basically clarifies the audit situation. As you know, all publicly financed candidates must be audited starting from 60 days from the date that the first election report after the election is filed. So it has to be started within 60 days. But that same provision, or same section, 1.150A, also allows the commission to perform other audits of other candidates, not necessarily publicly financed candidates. These could be candidate committees that are selected randomly, or candidate committees that are targeted audits. So what staff has done is rewrite 1.150 in a way that it makes clear that publicly financed candidates have to have their audits begun within 60 days, but the other audits could be started at a later time or at any time.
Okay. Comments from the commissioners?
Does even outside the 60-day window mean 6 months?
It could mean that. The reason it could mean that is, like, currently we have two auditors who are performing audits, and because they've been engaged in monitoring the public finance system in this election, they have not had the opportunity to perform many of the audits that need to be performed, especially for the publicly financed candidates from last year. While they have started them, they have not they have not been able to complete them. So it's really a matter of staffing needs. What we intend is for the public finance candidates' audits to begin, but the other audits, depending on our staffing needs and staffing availability, to have them start at a later time.
Sort of further to Commissioner Ward's question, I mean, I am a little worried that there's no sort of proposed time by which we would begin those audits. I mean, is there what would be a reasonable amount of time to allow the staff to audit those non-publicly financed candidates?
It's easy enough to start an audit and then just put it down and do other things, which is why some of these have taken more than a year. If you're concerned that we don't want to let people, like, walk away from a campaign and 4 years later suddenly find they're being audited, you could say, you know, a year or so. But if a campaign isn't audited and 2 years later we find out that there was some extensive wrongdoing, we should be able to go back and do a targeted audit or something like that.
How would you find there was wrongdoing?
Sometimes people go back and look at old records and find things that were missed the first time around. It's unlikely. But if we don't audit a campaign, for example, and a lot of non-PF campaigns don't get audited, the staff doesn't have a chance to look through the records and see mm-hmm. if everything appears to be done correctly. So I understand what you're concerned about happening. And we certainly make every attempt to get those audits done as soon as possible because we have elections every single year.
Right.
Let me just add that when we have random selection of audits, we do inform the committees that are selected almost immediately thereafter, and we tell them that they have to retain their records. We tell them what the law requires.
But is it possible that after random selection, it could take a year or 18 months before the audit actually begins?
Yes, it could.
Okay. Any further comments or questions from the commissioners?
I have a great reluctance to, in this case, vote for a measure that doesn't have a specific start time. Because it can extend out over what I think we all would agree could be an unreasonable period of time. And then you have, you know, the possibility of serial offenders. You know, if they're covering more than one election.
Do you have a sense of what would seem reasonable as an outer limit, or if you were going to create an edge, what it would be?
I don't, but I suppose I'd just say maybe twice the current amount of time, 120 days instead of 60 days, but I don't know whether or not that makes sense.
I think the competing concern... The competing concern is that I worry that a, I agree that I would very much like to see a time limit or a time by which it must begin, but I am worried that if it's too short, then we're going to have the problem, we're going to have the same problem, that we're not going to be able to start them, so we're not going to audit as much as we'd like to. So maybe something like a year is would meet that, meet the competing goals, but... That's based solely on...
I would say, well, that's, we're fine with that, but I would say the random audits have to be begun within a year. I'd like to leave the door open on the targeted ones.
And that is because we...
We only do targeted audits when we have evidence of wrongdoing.
Oh, I see. That's the...
What's the parameter now for targeted audits? Time parameter?
There isn't one. But target audits generally are priority because investigations are stalled while the audit is completed.
Any further comments? Public comment?
David Pilpel. Two things. I don't disagree. In fact, I am starting to agree pretty strongly that one should start as soon as possible. I think it would be good to be explicit and add language here that says essentially that losing candidates get dealt with first because they tend to leave town or disappear or go into hiding. Candidates who win, even if they, whether or not they use public financing, they tend to be around. We tend to be able to find them. It's the people who lose and have caused problems, and the commission has actually had some experience of folks disappearing. So putting in language, prioritizing losing candidates for would be helpful. With respect to the timing in general and targeted and random audits, if I'm reading this correctly, if it's within 60 days after the first post-election report, that's generally through the end of December, which is due like January 31st, February 1st, so it's within 60 days of that, so it's basically by April 1st-ish. It seems reasonable to me that by April 1st, after a November cycle, one should be able to start initiating an audit if it's a required audit, if it's something that comes up based on either being random or targeted based on evidence. I can see starting that later, but I would not, I'm agreeing with Commissioner Ward, I would not start that much later, maybe by July 1 of that year. I mean, this is not for a general purpose committee. This is for a specific election-related committee, although the treasurer still has record-keeping requirements for, what, 5 years, I think? Is it 5 years? 4 years? 5 years? If there isn't a good reason to start something by, like, July 1 of the following year, they should generally assume that they're done and they can move on with the rest of their lives. Again, unless there's some other evidence that comes up that requires something targeted. But even for the random audits, one should determine sometime in the early spring who's going to get nailed in a random audit and get started on it. Perhaps that helps. Thank you.
With respect to those suggestions, I think the suggestion to consider losing candidates is worthwhile and one that the staff can take into account, but I'd rather not. I'd be disinclined to tie the staff's hands.
It's already commission policy. Because we know where the elected people are going to be for the next 4 years. So we do those last.
And That's interesting, because I could make the argument that the people who are holding office are the ones in whom the public, I, as a member of the public, might have the most interest in knowing whether they had followed the rules, and that my confidence in the responsibility that office holders have is actually greater than losers. So it may, I could see competing reasoning that might relate to that choice.
Hi, Larry Bush. I'd like to recommend that you add language that allows this to be revisited as technology improves, because a great deal of auditing is going to have to do with technology and more reporting. And rather than lock yourself into a specific situation, at least allow a provision that says that every 6 months or every year you'll review technology aspects for auditing and upgrade the audit system to incorporate them.
With respect to the time by which non-publicly financed audits need to begin, do commissioners feel strongly that we need to put something in? Is that something we want to send the staff back with to figure out what that number should be? Any thoughts on that?
That's what I would recommend. I wouldn't leave it open-ended.
I would agree with putting a time limit on and maybe differentiating between the random and the targeted tested.
Could we recommend that it not be considered as part of this legislation then, so that on the provisions that the commission has already approved or will be approving, we can move forward to the Board of Supervisors with those and not have this as part of that.
Sure. So we'll essentially defer 7E as well.
Yes.
Okay.
Any objection to that? Okay. So the next decision point is decision point 8. Ms. Singh, would you like to?
Sure. Decision point 8 is basically some refinements to the definitions section of the CFRO. And many of these come from existing definitions, and this is really a way of consolidating provisions in the CFRO. And some of them also are new terms that we generally have talked about earlier, such as compliance costs, disclosure deadline that the commission has already approved.
Any comments on decision point 8? Public comment? Is there a motion to adopt the amendments proposed by the staff in decision point 8?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Decision point 9. Ms. Singh, would you like to?
I just had a clarifying
sure.
question. Since we talked at the last meeting about the disclosure deadline, I'm having trouble relating the different documents. Does the new version have the new definition of the disclosure deadline?
The new version, I think it does.
It does, okay. And that was incorporated? Okay, all right.
I can double check. Yes. Right.
Okay, right. All right. I will have an opportunity to reconcile all this stuff before it all done. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Pippel.
Decision point 9 is basically a series of new electronic notice provisions requiring the commission to provide email and online notice whenever the voluntary expenditure ceiling is accepted or lifted, or when the individual expenditure ceilings are lifted, I mean, are adjusted. This basically codifies existing practice. The only thing that what staff wants to do is to provide notices be sent by email only and not by regular mail. And generally speaking, this is what has been happening because all the candidates have given us their email addresses, and we do this by email.
And have the candidates been voluntarily agreeing that they don't need to receive it by mail?
Yes, yes.
Have you had any instance where a campaign has said, no, we want it by mail?
No. None that I'm aware of. I talk with Shaista Sheikh, who is the person who administers that program today, and she said, no, no one has.
Okay. Any comments from the commissioners? Public comment? Public comment?
David Pilpel, I agree that it makes sense. I just want to be sure, and I'm not asking to get on that list, but if someone, some third party, an interested person actually requested to receive mailed notice, would the commission say, no, we only do that by email, or would the commission make some arrangement?
No, it's just for that we would make an arrangement.
They would make an arrangement. Yeah. Thank you. Thank you. I mean, I'm thinking, for example, that we should also perhaps inform the press if we don't have a media list now. This doesn't require, for example, notifying the media. That would seem like an appropriate, you know, audience to inform of changes to the expenditure limits or ceilings, excuse me.
That the media may want it by mail?
No, that they may want it, that we may email them, but to the extent that we have a media list, if the ceilings are being lifted.
We do have a media list. That's why it goes out in the form of a press release.
Okay. But this section doesn't require that notice to the media, does it? I'm not reading it there.
No.
It does not. But we're currently doing that anyway, and we would continue to. All right.
The media gets all press releases that we issue.
Great, thanks.
Is there a motion with respect to decision point 9? Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Decision point 10.
Decision point 10 is basically technical changes to section 1.160.5. And what it does is it deletes subsection C5, which provides for late filing fines, because that subsection really duplicates what's already in section 1.170. Staff also proposes a series of minor technical amendments, just to clarify the language.
Any comments from the commissioners with respect to decision point 10? Public comment? Is there a motion to adopt decision point 10?
So moved.
Is there a second?
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Motion passes. Decision point 11.
Decision point 11 proposes to apply the prohibition on false endorsements to communications rather than just campaign ads. Communications is a broader term, and we believe that false endorsements, communications containing false endorsements are equally harmful whether they appear as advertisements or as communications. So it's just a broadening of the language.
Sounds reasonable.
Any other comments from the commissioners? Public comment, Mr. Pilpel?
Can staff just explain how this would play out in real terms? With respect to the difference between a communication and a campaign advertisement? Is there an example that you can point to that is not currently prohibited that would be under this?
You can have a candidate say on his or her website, which is not a campaign advertisement,
right,
that so-and-so supports him or her, when in actuality that's not the truth.
So this requires a heightened level of scrutiny for all campaign communications. So if they're going to say something, it needs to be verifiable
accurate.
Would this also govern third-party communications based on this definition?
No, I think it's everything, yeah.
So an independent expenditure that says so-and-so is supporting this, if they can't back it up, they've got a problem.
Right.
Okay. I mean, I think that's good. I'm just trying to think through, are there any other, are we creating other unintended consequences? No.
Well, it doesn't create an obligation in us to scour every one of them, but it gives us authority if someone, if we saw it or someone identified it for us.
But it creates an appropriate burden on all the various campaigns, their committees, their treasurers, everybody, to scrutinize stuff so they're not just putting things out there that are unverifiable and inaccurate. Right. But to the extent that that also applies to third-party spending, that's good right now. And there's no First Amendment problem with applying this to third-party spending? I'm not inviting one. I'm just.
Good question.
Our office has advised the commission confidentially on the First Amendment issues. Happy to do so again, at your request.
I'll just assume that it's not creating any new or big. Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Asking people to be accurate is probably a good idea. So.
Right.
If they want to argue about that and say, no, I have the right to be inaccurate and spend as much as I want saying whatever I want that's inaccurate, that would be a fun fight to get into. Let's bring it on, right?
Thank you.
Actually, a number of cases with people making exactly that argument.
I didn't go to law school either. Larry Bush.
Wise man.
But back in the 80s, I did work for then Assemblyman Art Agnos, who got voters to approve Proposition 20, which was a grounds for removal for office for anyone who won election by misrepresenting the positions of their opponent. And the California Supreme Court ruled that invalid. So I don't know what impact that has. It was a good policy. It was apparently just not legal. So I don't know what impact that has on making a false claim in these circumstances, but it would certainly seem to me to have some bearing on the issue. By communications, when you say that, I assume that that includes things like door hangers and so forth, or is that already covered? Is it already covered?
Seems like
any communication that's distributed to more.
But up until now, has it been covered?
No.
Well, that's a good thing.
I actually do have a question for staff. I'm looking at the actual language on page 39. And so was your intent to delete campaign advertisement or to add the communications, so a broad definition of communication in addition to campaign advertisements?
The new definition of communication would encompass campaign advertisements, so the definition of campaign advertisement with all its exceptions was no longer necessary because you had the broader definition of communications.
Okay, because the only instance I could think of is if, because now you've added this, distributed to more than 1,000 people of, and I guess if you just broadcast, then the assumption is it's more than 1,000 people, or is that a threshold that you think is, I'm just wondering about proving it's been distributed to more than 1,000 people if it's like, a billboard, I would assume more than 1,000 people see it, but I don't know how you would quantify that. And so I'm wondering if we should leave in, to really encompass everything, leave in campaign, the sort of the first, but then add in what you've proposed here instead of, I don't know, that's just an idea. thought I had as I was reading through it.
So right now, the thought is that even with this broad definition, there's an ambiguity with respect to whether, for example, a billboard is would be distributed to 1,000 or more people.
Right. So, yeah. Or maybe not.
I mean, in fact, it wouldn't. It's pretty clear that it wouldn't be distributed.
Right. That was my concern. That looking at the language, it's not something that's distributed, just something that's posted or something right.
So the definition of distributed, which is on page 3, the proposed definition of distributed.
Okay.
On page three of the last month's proposed ordinance is any act that permits a communication to be viewed, read, or heard. And then based on that distributed definition, we used that distributed definition throughout the proposed ordinance to, I'm trying to find some examples of it.
19, billboard is included as under the definition of communication.
Right.
Okay, good, okay.
Now I'm just looking for third-party reporting and publicly financed races.
But would it make sense to say to 1,000 people, distributed to more than 1,000 people for, anyway, I'm thinking this through out loud.
So currently, there's no numerical threshold?
Right.
Or there...
Sorry, flipping through. You're right. I see what you're saying.
Right. So what it makes... Right. That's all.
How do you... So the question is, how do you implement a numerical threshold with advertising that is publicly displayed in less conspicuous places?
Why do we care about a number?
I think it's a materiality question.
There are First Amendment concerns, as Mr. Pilpel and Mr. Bush express, and part of the way that this ordinance was crafted initially to address some of those First Amendment concerns is in the enforcement provisions, enforcement penalties on page 40. This false advertising restriction has its own enforcement provisions, narrow enforcement provisions with a requirement of a showing of clear and convincing evidence in order to address some of the concerns that they raised. So I think that's part of a threshold issue as well, in terms of what it makes sense for the city to go after in terms of these violations. Does that make sense? If I say to Mabel, Catherine endorses David Pilpel for supervisor, that is a communication that I've just,
Right.
So if I might, a couple of things that have now come up. So looking at the definition on page 2 of whichever version here of communication, and any mailing, flyer, email, door hanger, without reference to sort of size, and maybe in some cases size does matter. So if you're doing, a mass mailing to 60,000 people, I think being accurate is important. If you're doing a fundraising letter to 50 people, do we apply the same standard? And if it's under 200 pieces, it's not a mass mailing, there's no filing requirement. I'm not even sure there's a record-keeping requirement. So, and I definitely understand billboards and sort of mass communications. What? No? And the same thing applies with respect to door hangers, pamphlets, some of these other things, where you've got sort of a large audience that matters, then yeah, absolutely. If it's a smaller size audience,
so maybe we should...
should the level of scrutiny be the same is my question. Maybe the answer is yes. We want everything to be 100% good and legit and all of that. Maybe not. And I'm not sure if we're at a point now of being that granular and needing to care. Maybe now is the time to be talking about that.
Well, to the extent that there's a definition like mass mailing that has a number, might it be possible to keep that same sense of scope and say that, you know, that analogizes to it, that mm-hmm. has the reach either of that number of items or for other matters that is intended to reach or, you know, mm-hmm. I'm groping for actually how to express it. But so the one phone call that is inaccurate doesn't count, but the 240-person robocall does.
Right. And I think both recorded telephone messages and persuasion polls, we've established a threshold amount above which, at or above which we care, below which we don't care so much. And maybe depending on the type of communications in sub H, page 2, we would want to say these things above a threshold matter and below less scrutiny.
Possibly.
How does this kind of discussion comport with the desire to move them through to the board? Yeah, if we're looking at amendments.
I would ask the question of what about multiple mailings that are different pieces,
mm-hmm.
but with the same inaccurate information, that are distributed over time, that cumulatively add up to a significant number, where alone they might seem insignificant, but language, but it still has that inaccurate information.
Well, if I might, the definition of mass mailing in state law is 200 or more substantially similar pieces mailed within a 30-day period. So you could argue that even if you change the color and the this and the that, if you've got substantially similar text or some big chunk of it, that collectively you've done segments of what's now a mass mailing and you're subject to all the things that you're appropriately subject to. That would be my take on it.
I think the only issue is that the mass mailing rules cover mass mailings and not TV ads and radio ads and
right.
other things that are maybe distributed once, billboards that are put up once and may reach an enormous number of people.
How did we come to 1,000?
I can't remember. No. I can't remember how we got that. But I do have a suggestion based on all the comments that have been made. On line 9 and page 39, perhaps we can say no person may spend more than $1,000 to pay for, direct, supervise, authorize, or distribute any communication that clearly identifies a candidate or measure is distributed within 90 days prior to an election for that candidate or measure and contains a false endorsement where the person acts with the knowledge of the falsity, et cetera. So instead of having 1,000 people, which may be difficult to ascertain, you can put a price tag on it. If it's $1,000 or more, you can't do it. No? Yes?
Interesting idea.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder, though, whether this is one where we put off, hear what
we can
what
do that
they
too.
Say at, people say at the interested person's meeting.
What?
Miss.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Am I doing all right?
Miss Mayo?
Hi, Anita Mayo, Pillsbury Winthrop Shaw Pittman. I think the $1,000 may have come because the staff may have wanted to be consistent. Under the persuasion polls, what triggers filing is completing at least 1,000 completed calls. I think there's the same provision, and it's not here, with the electioneering communications. I believe it's 1,000 in the electioneering communications, I thought. But I don't have it here. In terms of the billboard, trying to figure out how do you get 1,000, you can just put a presumption in the statute that it's presumed it's going to be 1,000 if you have a billboard or if there's a radio or a TV ad. You just build the presumption into the statute that way.
The only hesitation I have is that internet can slide through in the sense that the marginal cost of an email communication is so tiny that you can reach very, very large numbers of people with virtually no out-of-pocket or actual cost. So I don't know whether it needs to be or it's terribly cumbersome, but if it could be, if this is what we're looking for, $1,000 or 1,000 people, because you would know that something went to 1,000 people. But, you know, just some of them have a price tag and some of them could have great reach but no price tag, which I know from the contribution side is a reason that you get so many emails.
Mr. Bush.
Hi, Larry Bush. Just to illustrate the commissioner's point, we just did internet ads in the Bay Guardian with had 80,000 impressions that went out. It was $900. Would not have fallen under your threshold. We could have done things a lot cheaper too.
Okay, so unless there are objections from the commissioners, I would propose we table this one, see what comes out of the interested persons meetings, and unless executive John Trek, you have any? Okay, the next item is decision point 12. Ms. Singh, do you want to give us a brief?
Sure. Decision point 12 basically proposes deletion of sections 1.161, 1.161.5, 1.162, and 1.163 because these provisions would have already been incorporated in the new sections that were approved by the commission at the last meeting. So this is basically a cleanup based on what the commission did at the last meeting.
At the last meeting in October?
Yes. When the commission adopted the third party consolidating a lot of these requirements for third party reports, consolidating a lot of these.
Comments from the commissioners? Public comment on this item?
David Pilpel, I think I'm with this. I'm looking for a moment at the chart in the September 8th memo that followed. If staff could update this chart at some point so that there's, in my mind, for each type of activity, regardless of what section it's under, but the activity, and we sort of talked about this a moment ago, what's the disclaimer or disclosure requirement on the piece or in connection to the communication? That's item one. What is the filing obligation, if there's a filing obligation with the commission or FVPC or whoever? And third, that's not on this list, is what is the record keeping obligation? So for each thing, so that we can all sort of understand what this is, you know, if you've got a recorded telephone message, da-da-da-da, you need to say this, you need to keep that, you need to do that, right? Some of this is captured, and that's very helpful, but sort of getting it for each type of thing that's currently in the definition of a communication and whatever things that we could see possibly on the horizon would be good. I don't know, for example, in a...
Mr. Pilpel, with all due respect, I think this was meant. Are you talking about this chart in Appendix A?
Yeah.
I mean, that was intended to aid our discussion of this, of these regulations. I mean,
and what I'm suggesting is that a version of this would be very helpful for candidates, third parties, and other interested folks to understand how these play out in real time. That this is kind of the distillation of the thing. This is good stuff. But I don't know that it's yet complete because we've talked some more about, you know, billboards and other things. It's not, for example, obvious with a billboard, I'm sure that you can put, you know, in 14-point type on a, you know, large size billboard paid for by Joe Smith for treasurer. I'm not sure that that deals with the intent of clearly communicating. So somehow it should say, you know, 14-point or something audible or visible in the medium that it exists in. Does that make sense? Okay. Anyway, whether or not it's done as part of this package, I would hope that staff would update this for future guides and other communications for folks so that the real-life examples are as clear as possible. Thanks.
Sir, is there a motion? Sorry. Did you have something to say? Is there a motion with respect to decision point 12? Anybody? I move that we adopt the amendments proposed in decision point 12. Is there a second?
I'll second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Opposed? 13.
13 is basically an overall approval of the draft amendments. So we attempted to talk to every major, address every major decision point. There may have been some minor technical amendments that we did not address. So hopefully this is a time for the commission to say, yes, we agree with the recommendations.
Comments from the commissioners? Public comment on this item?
Well, then just with respect to the last page, the operative date, I don't think that we're making January 1 here. If the commission votes on this in a moment, that would then get forwarded to the board. It would have to sit there for 30 days and wouldn't get enacted until at the earliest mid to late December, and then would take effect 30 days thereafter. So unless there's some reason to have a date certain in here, then you could eliminate that section and it would, by operation of law, take effect 30 days after final approval by the mayor. I mean, in practical terms, I don't know that there's going to be much campaign activity in early 2012. So I'm not sure that it matters that much. I'm just trying to think through if there are any finance implications, particularly if you take the action that you're contemplating on the next thing to delay certification.
I think the staff's intent was to originally, when we were looking at this in March or April, was to adopt it in September and then have it sit around and go into effect in January. So I'm tempted to say, let's just delete that language, except that it's our office's practice now to always include the effective and operative dates. And so I can stick in the boilerplate, I'm forgetting exactly what it would say, it would basically be 30 days after approval by the mayor. So if you authorize me to do that, I think that's fine, and then we move forward to the board that way.
And I think the only other cleanup item is on page 1, line 17, section is in there twice.
So, I'm sorry, can you say that one again?
Page 1, line 17. We're here to help.
Oh.
And I'm sorry, just to complete, to the extent that you agree with all of these changes that have been made and if you vote and forward this out now, the items that you've reserved, either for staff for further review or for the IP meeting or some other process, those are not going forward with this package. This is just a package of, let's say, moderate cleanup stuff, but it doesn't, and it makes some substantive changes, but it doesn't make like massive programmatic changes. That is being held for those other things. Okay, so there may be several things in the pipeline to amend CFRO. Okay.
I think that's a fair characterization that there's
okay. Very good.
There are other things under consideration, definitely.
Thank you.
Okay. Is there a motion to adopt decision point 13 with the caveat that we will clarify the effective date and in addition fix the typo on page 1, line 17?
So moved.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Aye. All opposed? Motion passes. Before we move on, just wanted to thank again the staff and the public for all your help with these. And we know that there is a lot of additional work ahead and look forward to the staff and the public's findings what we can learn about how to make the system work going forward in light of the new legal landscape that we face. The next item on the agenda is consideration of legislation to delay certification of supervisorial candidates.
Because the redistricting commission may not finish their work until March or April, it could have an impact on some candidates' residency requirements. What this will do is hold off on distribution of funds until those lines have been certified by the redistricting commission. Candidates for supervisor will still be able to apply for funds in February, and the staff will be able to do all the paperwork and everything. But the actual checks won't be cut until we know what the final lines look like.
Comments from the commissioners? I agree with that sentiment. Public comment.
David Pilpel, I think I actually had suggested this at a couple of meetings ago. So certainly with the concept, I'm just trying to, again, play this out. So what's not clear is once, you know, we or those who draw the lines do that, does the commission staff currently have a process to determine if someone is in the district? Because there may be, like, lines moved late one night and the person comes in the next day and says, where's my check? I would hope that the commission has a way to determine, and I'm not sure how that would be now, that someone is in the new district, because they may get districted out or, you know, move from one district to another. And although their paperwork may be in order, they may just, you know, now be a block out of the district. So I don't think it's just a question of cutting the check. I think it's a question of determining eligibility, which is not just the monetary amounts, but it's actually their residency. And I'm not sure how quickly elections is going to be able to re-precinct and the thing based on the maps. I mean, we may decide on something and the meets and bounds, you know, it may not be as quick and obvious as some might hope. I'm not suggesting delaying it further. I'm just sort of suggesting that staff have some plan in mind for how to make this work.
So I don't read this as providing the staff with a deadline by which to make its determination.
Staff still has to certify but cannot do so until the lines have been drawn.
Right, after and April 15th. So presumably the staff will do so after it's clear what the lines are. And so your overnight example,
right.
I think, is...
So part of the certification process will, in fact, be verifying that the candidate is in the new district, however that has to happen.
I don't think
that's not what I'm saying.
I don't think the staff verifies the residence of the applicants for public financing. Although, if I'm that's right. The candidate submits a declaration asserting that the candidate is eligible to run for office, And one of the eligibility criteria is living in the district. So it's not that they have to do an investigation to certify the act qualifications.
But if I say
I was just going to say, I imagine that they look at the address and whether the address is within the lines, not the more complicated question of residency,
I'm not trying to raise residency or citizenship or any of those issues, but just if someone says I'm on, you know, Arguello, and it turns out that Arguello is now not in the district, then even if they meet it for other reasons, it would seem to me like they cannot be certified because they're not eligible. They're no longer eligible to be a candidate.
But that doesn't sound like it is it. That's nothing new. They now have to currently get the certification that the person meets all of those. And I don't think this changes it. It's only that if they were to do it before this date, they might make one that is no longer appropriate to the new district lines.
Okay. I mean, so part of it is the address. The other is if someone really ends up being like in or out by a block, but the entire shape of the district changes, you know, which is possible, although they might have gathered funds and qualified, they might choose to end their candidacy right there because they don't think that they are viable anymore in the newly constituted district. So to the extent that someone has filed paperwork that's on hold, there might be an additional step to contact them and say, are you still going forward and shall we complete your certification? If so, we'll get back to you because we're working through it now. But if you choose to end things now, you may do that as well. I'm just trying to think through these possibilities. And in some districts, that's perhaps more possible than in others.
I mean, that's a good point.
I mean, it's procedural.
Yeah.
I think staff can handle it.
Okay. Yeah, I think Commissioner Hand's right. Your concerns are noted, and I understand them, but I don't think that's something we have
to. Yeah, no. I don't think it gets in the way of the legislation. It seemed like this was the right time to raise that because I don't know if staff is going to be promulgating any regs or doing something to better define certification in this context. So I think my points have been made. Thank you.
Thank you. Is there a motion with respect to the draft legislation to delay certification?
I move that we accept the recommendation.
Second. All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Passes. Next item on the agenda is the minutes to the meeting. Any proposed changes? Commissioners? Pilpel?
The only thing I found so far is on page 7, Anita Mayo is misspelled.
Heavens. Badly.
Scandalous, I know. Thank you.
Any other changes proposed? Is there a motion to adopt the minutes as amended on page 7 to correctly spell Ms. Mayo's name?
So moved.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Passes. Agenda item 10, the executive director's report.
Okay. I just want to point out that the revenue report is last month's numbers because there were two staff members out when this report was produced. Both of them are the ones that have the capability to run that report. We'll have the updated numbers next month. it's staff is kind of exhausted. I did testify at the Government Audit Oversight Committee last week, where they did unanimously adopt legislation requiring Ethics Commission hearings to be televised. Supervisor Campos wanted to amend it to include the Sunshine Task Force, but was unable to do that. I understand he's introducing a separate legislation, just for your information. We're all set for televised meetings starting in January. There I go again. The fourth Monday, not the last Monday, the fourth Monday. They're not always the same. And all of us are due for our state-mandated anti-harassment training. So I will be sending you instructions for how to do that. It's an online tutorial that you watch, and then there's a certificate generated at the end after you take a quiz. So I will be sending you step-by-step instructions to do that. That's it.
Thank you, and thank you to the staff for getting us through a busy election season. Appreciate all the hard work that we know went into it. Items for a public comment on the report?
David Pilpel on item four, page four, item six, sorry. The reference to Prop F. I believe that, in fact, Prop F did fail, though it's not on your agenda tonight, but perhaps you want to bring that up at a future meeting to decide what to do about that. I assume that we're just going to continue to live with the ordinance as it is for the moment, and whether or not we try again in June, next November, or attempt to make changes, hear the opponents do something, might be worth talking about. It was certainly good enough to put on the ballot, and we're still stuck with what we're stuck with, so kind of figuring out what to do next probably would be a wise thing at a future meeting. Thanks.
Thank you.
Larry Bush. Since Proposition F was brought up, I'd just like to say that I was a member of the group that worked to oppose Prop F. It did lose by 57% to 43%. We met with over 30 community groups who ended up voting to oppose Prop F, largely because of their feelings about the Ethics Commission. There was not a problem so much with any of the technical aspects of it. It was the one provision that said that the Ethics Commission could later on make other adjustments with the approval of the board and supermajorities in both cases. And I think that all the people who were involved in this, that included five former ethics commissioners, would be happy to talk to the Ethics Commission about what the issues were and ways in which to move forward, because I think that there is general agreement that the campaign consultants ordinance does need to be updated in many ways, but there also are concerns about issues that have come up in the past year with the Ethics Commission, as you know, from the civil grand jury thing. This particular makeup of commissioners have made a number of steps that have been well received in the community, but you still have what I guess what they call a political hangover of a record that is less satisfactory. You're working your way out of that, but there's still a number of issues that need to be addressed. So on behalf of Friends of Ethics, as we call it ourselves, we'd be happy to meet individually or with others in a group about the issues that we heard when we were out talking to people and voters around the city. It won't be harsh. We'll be kind.
Commissioner Ward has announced that he is maybe I should let Commissioner Ward speak.
Well, this is likely to be my last meeting. I've submitted my resignation. I've been on the Ethics Commission now for 6 years, so it's probably time for me to step aside and let someone else do their public service. I've appreciated and enjoyed the opportunity to work with all of you and actually all of the other commissioners that have come through during the time that I've been here. I've especially appreciated all the support and fine work that the staff has done while I've been on the commission. And I think that public service is important. This is the second commission that I've sat on, so I've served, probably more than 10 years as a volunteer on commissions in the city. As Shirley Chisholm once said, it's the rent that we pay for being here. So I've done it willingly, and I suppose if I'm called upon sometime in the future to serve on another commission, I'd seriously consider doing that. But I'm going to miss you all. But between September and January on Monday nights, I'm going to be watching Monday Night Football.
Well, Commissioner Ward, I think I speak for my fellow commissioners when I say that we've greatly appreciated your service and your wise insights and pragmatic approach to the issues that we face. And I know I personally have learned a great deal about how to serve on this commission from you, and have cherished your comments and guidance on all these issues.
You're here.
And I just want to say for me and the staff to thank you very much. It's your intellect and your insights have been great. You challenge us a lot. You challenge our thinking, and that makes us, want to work hard to be prepared and to be ready. And that's a great thing, because keeping us on our toes is the best thing you could do for the folks on the staff. And so we always like that you have, the terrific insights and always look for the motivations behind things. And it's been a learning, growing experience that we've enjoyed. And sincerely, we'll miss you terribly.
I'll come back and visit. I'll come in.
Come and make public comment.
Come and make public comment.
We're going to hold you to that and continually ask for your presence. Thank you very much, Commissioner Ward. Is there a... Didn't we do that? Items for future meetings?
I have a question, which I think fits here. There's been some public comment, editorials, and so forth about the public finance system that San Francisco has. I just wonder if there are any limitations or constraints on commissioners conversing about that issue, either if it comes up or if we wanted to seek inquiry, if we were invited to talk about it?
No, it's, the limitations on the commission and the commission staff are on political activity, but educational and the dissemination of factual information and the receipt of opinions and input is encouraged and welcome.
What about dissemination of opinions that could be at issue at a commission hearing?
Well, it wouldn't be the first time commissioners expressed opinions about commission business off of campus.
Or or might be in the categories you were describing now, but at some point be on the ballot later.
And you can talk about it just, until when it... Like Prop F. We could talk about Prop F while we were discussing it. But once it became a ballot measure, our lips were effectively sealed.
It does seem that that's a conversation that our community may be having in the days to come. Thank you.
In addition, I know I've said this before, but I do very much look forward to the results of the interested persons meeting with respect to the CFRO amendments. I mean, there are big sort of systemic issues we should probably be considering, and I think it behoove us to consider those as soon as we feel we're ready to do so. Is there a
public comment?
Larry Bush, I'd like to suggest that the commission schedule a conversation about contractor prohibition and the way in which they're handled. It remains an outstanding issue. It was an issue that came up in the course of this campaign, but I think that the issue is also larger about the fact that contractors, while prohibited from making direct contributions, are permitted to solicit others to make contributions, can serve on finance committees, can be bundlers, and all the rest of that. And I'm not sure that that's, I think that's a topic that deserves a discussion by the commission. And I'd like to recommend that you do that.
David Pilpel, I just want to touch on what Larry suggested to broaden it a little bit, having been involved in several campaigns, including one in this past cycle as a volunteer. Campaigns often get checks from a variety of sources. Some are individuals, some it's not clear. For cash flow and other purposes, campaigns often want to rush to the bank and make, you know, copy the check, rush to the bank, make the deposit so that they have money available. And if there's a problem with it later, they'll pay it back, pay the fine, fundraise it, whatever they have to do, but at least they'll have the funds available initially to do whatever it is they're doing. I think that kind of makes sense, but it ought to be very well tempered with, is this a legal contribution that I can accept and deposit, which sometimes they're interested in, sometimes they're less interested in, and whether it's a contractor contribution, someone who's over the aggregate limit, a business entity that could be a corporation, might not be, isn't entirely clear, that it's a check that's a trust and it's from a trustee, or you can't tell whether it's the husband or the wife who signed the thing. I think that there are some steps or some guidance that the commission could give to campaigns and treasurers about how to validate a contribution, and to the extent that it can't be validated quickly, to put it aside and do some more diligence. Again, some are better at this than others. Some that have professionals are better and have ways to deal with it. But there are a number of campaigns, and we've referenced this in past meetings, that don't necessarily have professionals, don't have a lot of support people. And they're just like, hey, we got a $500 check. Let's go deposit it. And I am often a lonely voice saying, well, you really ought to be sure that it's a legal contribution before you run off to deposit it. And so some advice on how to deal with that as broadly as possible, I think, would help in the community and really promote compliance. I would rather they do it right rather than have to pay a fine and pay it back later. Let's have them do it right the first time. Anyway, anything that one can do to help would be good, and not just in guides, but in real, you know, examples. Thanks.
Is there a motion to adjourn the meeting?
I think we should let Charles make it.
I move that we adjourn.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye. Aye.